Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Do you have a medical condition that could interfere with work or school? Maybe not enough money to cover future medical expenses? Do you have financial liabilities, a low credit score, no private health insurance, or no college degree? Have you been approved to receive a public benefit like food stamps or Medicaid? Well, if you've experienced any of those things in life and you are not a U.S. citizen or not already a legal permanent resident, the Trump administration believes you are or could become a public charge. And because of that, the administration is moving forward with sweeping new regulations that could deny green cards to legal immigrants who could become public charges, even for relatively short periods of time. Advocates say it's the right move towards a more merit-based immigration system. Critics say it's a move to radically cut legal immigration. So this hour on Point, the Trump administration's new rules around being a public charge and immigration. And you can join us. Are you an immigrant hoping for a green card? Could this new rule or new regulation have an impact on you? Or do you think it's the right way to go, that immigrants should be required to stand on their own two feet, as the Trump administration says? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we will start first today in Washington with Ted Hessen, immigration reporter for Politico Pro. Ted, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's go through some of the details as we know them so far of this 800-plus page set of regulations from the Trump administration. Who would this new public charge rule apply to?
This is a sweeping new regulation that's actually looking at people who have used or are currently using or may use in the future a certain set of public benefits. And to determine that, they're actually have a multi-part test that will look at factors like their age, their health, whether they have children or not, their income, and also their education and skills, and say, you know, based on that, are they likely to use these certain benefits that have been named in the regulation?
Okay, so there's a lot even just in that in that description there. Does it apply to immigrants who are already in the United States but haven't yet secured legal permanent resident status, or does it also apply to those outside of the United States who are hoping to come over and get a green card?
That's right. I mean, one of the most watched parts of this will be its effect on people who are applying for green cards. It will apply to people applying for visas, of all types. But I think most specifically, it's going to be the effect on those people who are adjusting to a green card, which is another way to say becoming a legal permanent resident. Previously, this standard, what's known as the public charge statute, had not been frequently used, even though it's been on the books dating back to the 1800s. There hasn't been a formal definition of it in federal immigration law. There had been some guidance issued in 1999 that specifically said it would apply to people using cash assistance and who were in long-term institutionalized care. Now, this new regulation from the Trump administration greatly expands that definition. It you mentioned, it's a more than 800-page federal rule, and it will now apply that to a wider range of benefits, including food stamps, welfare, Medicaid, and housing assistance. And the difference here is these are non-cash benefits, and they're being looked at for the first time to determine a potential public charge denial of a visa.
And how long for those immigrants who have used these benefits or have relied on them, for how long a period of time would they have had to rely on them in order for them to then later become ineligible for a green card under these new rules?
Well, I should be really clear. The standard is saying you're either using these benefits at the moment or you're likely to use them in the future. It's not necessarily you don't have to have necessarily used them. But the test is that you would have been likely to use these in a 12-month period out of a 36-month period. So for a year out of 3 years. And they say that if you've used two of the benefits, for instance, if you used food stamps and you used welfare, that would count as 2 months in that period towards your 12 months. But again, I should stress, this isn't that you've actually used the benefits, it's that you've been deemed likely to use them.
Okay. So tell us a little bit then about why the Trump administration is pushing forward with this.
This is, you know, in a way, it's a way to accomplish President Trump's vision of merit-based immigration. I mean, he's pushed several pieces, at least one major piece of legislation back in 2017 that would have favored what he deemed skilled immigrants over family-based connections. And as a result, it would have cut legal immigration in half over the course of a decade. And many people view this as a way for them to achieve that goal without actually getting Congress to pass a bill. This is also, it kind of meets two major Republican talking points together. I mean, one is it's clamping down on immigration, the legal type, not illegal immigration in this case. But it's also saying that they want fewer people to use public benefits. And they're saying, you know, they're aiming to discourage the use of those benefits through this.
Mm. Now, I understand that Stephen Miller, the president's close advisor, has long been pushing for this to finish this new rule. And that, in fact, the previous head of USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Francis Cisna, he was pushed out because he had resisted the rush to finish this rule. And then Ken Cuccinelli was put in as acting director. Is that right?
We had known this was a high priority for Stephen Miller, who is essentially, he's a White House senior advisor, but also viewed as the architect of President Trump's immigration agenda. And we had heard he had been pushing this for some time, but emails that I received through a Freedom of Information Act request a few weeks ago actually showed a really stunning exchange between him and former USCIS Director Francis Cisna, saying that it had been an embarrassment that the agency hadn't been able to publish a major regulation and that the timeline for the public charge rule wouldn't work. At one point, he emailed a separate official and said it needed to be done in days and weeks and not in months. And this was back in June 2018. And as it progressed, it did take months, actually, to get a draft version of the rule out. That eventually happened in October of 2018. And here we are in August of 2019 with the finalized version. So you can see that the regulatory process did take some time, even if Miller was pushing back in June 2018 to get this done faster.
Okay. We will hear in a couple of minutes from other voices who have differing views on these new set of rules and regulations. But first, let's listen to some tape of Ken Cuccinelli, acting head of USCIS. Again, that's Citizenship and Immigration Services. He spoke on Morning Edition, on NPR's Morning Edition just yesterday, about this new rule. And host Rachel Martin asked Cuccinelli what immigrants should be welcomed in the United States. And here's how Ken Cuccinelli answered.
All immigrants who can stand on their own two feet, be self-sufficient, pull themselves up by their bootstraps, again, as in the American tradition. My Italian-Irish heritage looks back at that. Most people in America look back at that. And that's what we expect going forward. This is a 140-year-old tradition in this country legally, and President Trump's leadership, and he intends to carry this forward, and this rule will be an important part of that effort.
Would you also agree that Emma Lazarus's words etched on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor," are also part of the American ethos?
They certainly are. Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge.
That's Ken Cuccinelli, acting head of USCIS, speaking to NPR's Rachel Martin. Ted, so let me just ask you about the future possibility of using public benefits here. I mean, there were all those factors that you listed out that the government's going to be looking at. I mean, does that mean that ostensibly an immigrant now who's waiting for a green card in the United States, or we may soon apply for a green card, if they simply don't have a couple of $100 in the bank in savings, which is not uncommon in the United States, even for U.S. citizens, that in and of itself could disqualify them from having a green card, because the government would look at them as saying, well, in the future, you might need government assistance?
Well, as I mentioned, there's a fairly complicated set of criteria that immigration officials will take into account as they try and determine whether someone will become what they're calling a public charge. And those things involve your age, your health, but also your income, which will obviously be a major thing that they'll look at. And they have what they call heavily weighted positive or negative factors. And one heavily weighted positive factor would be an income that they said would be 250% of the federal poverty guideline. lines. So for a single person, for instance, that's about $31,000 a year in income. For a family of four, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $64,000, I believe. So, I mean, it's, you know, each person can decide what they think standing on their own two feet means. But, you know, in their, I think critics would say that in an immigrant's lifetime, is it reasonable to expect that they would never dip below those income thresholds or come to need some of these benefits that have been mentioned in the regulation?
Huh. Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Edith, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Edith, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually just appalled by Cuccinelli's statement. I think statistically speaking, his immigrants were not likely at all to have met the thresholds that he is imposing today. But I'm also really calling because I'm aware of immigrants who have recently arrived who came over with nothing, but while they were here, went to school, got degrees, and they did rely on public assistance during that time, but now they are productive and self-supporting members of our society.
Mm. Well, Edith, thank you so much for your call. Ted Hessen with Politico Pro, let me turn back to you. This rule, when it was first proposed, it got a lot of public comment. I mean, how much did the public respond to the first intimations that the Trump administration wanted to do this?
That's right. Well, this published back in October of 2018, and there was really a stunning outpour response from the public, something like 266,000 public comments. And what that means in federal government is that the Homeland Security Department actually has to take those comments, review them, consider them and respond to them in some cases. So you actually see that in this final regulation that's issued. There were things that they changed in the final version because they took into account that perhaps it would have presented an undue burden on people. But I think the final changes have not been satisfactory for the opponents of it. And as we saw yesterday, there was even a lawsuit already filed in federal court in California that's challenging this regulation.
Well, we have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll hear from other voices on this issue of the public charge and legal immigration in the United States. Meanwhile, we've got comments pouring in here. Evan Mason on Facebook says, when thousands upon thousands of immigration applications are rejected every year, we can perhaps afford to be picky with who we let in. Perhaps we can give that social assistance to the plenty of our disadvantaged and poor citizens we have already. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the Trump administration's new regulations, which could go into effect some 60 days from now, that would change how legal immigrants may be eligible for green cards. It's a public charge rule that the Trump administration is putting out there, and we want to know what you think about it. Ted Hessen is with us. He is an immigration reporter for Politico Pro, and now also joining us, both from Washington as well, is Jackie Vimo. She's a policy analyst for the National Immigration Law Center. That's a center focused on immigration policy, litigation, and advocacy. And they are one of the groups that already plans to file a lawsuit against the administration's public charge rule. Jackie Vimo, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington as well is Mark Krikorian. He's executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank that argues for lower levels of immigration to the United States. Mark Krikorian, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
So, Jackie, first let me start with you. What do you see as the potential immediate impact of the Trump administration's public charge rule?
Well, first of all, there's already been an impact. And I think it's important to note that in many ways, this rule doesn't even have to go into effect for it to have the impact that it seeks. Rumors about this rule have been floating around for about 2 years, actually 2.5 years. And already in that time, there's been data from the Urban Institute, from Children's Health Watch, from the Migration Policy Institute that has shown that there's been a chilling effect on immigrants not accessing benefits, and including among those immigrants and their children, often who are U.S. citizens, basically being scared away from accessing those benefits. And so one is that this is already having an impact. And I think it's also important to note that this is part of a broader context. This is part of the broader tool of terror toolkit that the Trump administration is implementing, which includes putting children in cages, the census question, the Mississippi raids, attacks on mixed status housing, sponsor liability, and on and on and on. And the message that all of these types of initiatives are sending are that if you're not wealthy and you're not white, you're not welcome here. And as Ted mentioned earlier, the Trump administration has wanted to try and radically reshape the immigration system. Stephen Miller himself, as listed in Politico, said that he thought that this particular public charge rule would be transformational. But this is because they weren't able to get their bill through Congress, right? This is an end run around Congress to completely change their immigration system. They have been trying to fund the wall on the southern border, and this is an invisible wall, right? And the tools and the bricks of this wall are an attack on housing, healthcare, food and nutrition, and the well-being of immigrants and their family members.
So, Jackie, I'll come back to you in a second, but Mark Krikorian, let me turn to you here. What do you see as the real goal here? I mean, is the real goal to move towards a much more clear-cut, quote-unquote, merit-based system here? Or is the goal to reduce the amount of legal immigration to the United States?
It's going to have almost no effect on the level of immigration. It may have some very small effect, but it's not really about the numbers of immigrants let in. The point of this rule is to put into practice the basic principle, the foundational principle of American immigration law, which is that people who move here should be people who can pay their own bills. This is not something that was just enacted in the 1800s. It was in federal law. But before that, the states and even the colonies ran immigration policy. And the very first immigration legislation ever enacted was in Massachusetts Bay in 1645, and it was a public charge provision. The whole point, in a sense, of immigration is to make sure that people who move here are people who can pay their own bills and support themselves. The specific purpose of this regulation is to refine the 1999 rules that Ted referred to that the Clinton administration issued. There wasn't a formal rule. It was just instructions to the staff of what was then still the INS. And it was a kind of surreal, almost Orwellian definition of what should be counted as welfare in making these decisions. And that is that only cash benefits count as welfare, which is to say TANF and SSI, to use the initials of the programs. Mm-hmm. The fact is that under the existing rules that this rule will overturn in 60 days when it goes into effect, is that if you did not get cash benefits but either had or were likely to be using food stamps, living in public housing, and using Medicaid, you would somehow magically be considered self-supporting. And that's just not self-supporting. The point to immigration should be that ideally no immigrants should ever be on welfare. In other words, they should be less likely to be on welfare than Americans. The interesting point about this reg is that instead of doing what Republican politicians have been trying to do for a long time now, which is let in lots of immigrants, but then try to wall off the welfare state. So they're already here, but try to keep them from being able to access welfare. This is, in my opinion, more sensible and sort of moves upstream to try to not let in people in the first place who were likely to be using welfare. And there's hundreds of millions of people who would move here, so it's not like it's really going to have any effect on the numbers of immigrants, just the who ends up getting picked.
Yeah, so let me get Jackie Vimo, give her a chance to respond to that. Do you think it's not going to, Jackie, do you think it's not going to have an impact in terms of the numbers of legal immigrants to the United States?
Well, as I mentioned, we already know, and there was a statement from the American Academy of Pediatrics saying that it's already having an impact. But I think more importantly, we have to recognize how radical this is, right? When we talk about it's supposedly going to go after this issue of self-sufficiency. And I think coming from the Trump administration, it's pretty easy to talk about self-sufficiency when your father gives you a $400 million loan. But that aside, I think that the future shouldn't really be dependent on, you know, how rich your parents were, the color of your skin. And this rule is not about self-sufficiency. The libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute, acknowledges that you can be 95% self-sufficient and get just 5% of your support from one of these programs and still be considered a public charge. In fact, one in half of those who are currently in the country today wouldn't pass the public charge test if it were applied to them. And that we're talking about U.S. citizens who are living here today. Half of us wouldn't actually pass this test because this is a radical shift. The original idea of this public charge idea was, I mean, targeted at Irish paupers living in almshouses, completely destitute. The old definition until this morning was someone who is primarily dependent on the government for subsistence. This new definition, which is someone who is likely to use a public benefit, is a radical shift from that because, one, we have a totally different welfare state than we did back over 100 years ago. Many people work one or two jobs, and maybe they use some food stamps or they get some housing assistance just to make it through hard times. But that doesn't mean that they're not going to come out in the end in the future and that they're not going to be able to, thanks to being healthier and better fed and housed, have the opportunity to improve in their careers and do better in the long term. Yeah. So I think that that's sort of ultimately when we talk about self-sufficiency, this is not about people being dependent on the government. It's about kids going hungry for no reason, kids with asthma not getting inhalers. We know that moms are returning breast pumps to WIC. That's what the impact of this is, not so-called self-deficiency.
Well, Mark, I'm going to turn back to you here in a second, but on the point that Jackie Vimo's making, let's play a little bit of tape from Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy from Illinois. He was on CNN talking about his belief of the importance of having access to public benefits for legal immigrants.
I myself am the beneficiary of these programs during a time when my parents went through economic challenges. But thanks to the incredible generosity and goodwill of the people of the United States, we then got back on our feet, became contributing members of society. And indeed, I would not be in the halls of Congress today but for those programs.
So, Mark Krikorian, respond to that, because I keep coming back to this idea of how is the government supposed to know, you know, it's got these various factors, you know, if an immigrant family or a particular individual who may actually be able to, quote unquote, stand on their own two feet right now. I mean, the reality of American life is that all it takes is a month or two of economic difficulty and you might have to touch the public benefit system, but then you get back on your feet. Now, I mean, if even the possibility of touching the benefit system is enough to keep people out, aren't we closing the doors to people like future Congressman Krishnamurthy's?
The government's never going to be able to know in individual cases what's going to happen. There's no question that any time you make these kind of determinations, there are going to be specific instances where things could have turned out differently. There's no question about that. But government policy needs to be made based on broad factors. In other words, what is likely to happen on average? And the fact is that if you are somebody who has very little education coming into a modern post-industrial knowledge-based economy that's completely different from what existed 100 or 200 years ago, you could well be very hardworking. Most immigrants work at the same rates that Americans do. But as Jackie pointed out, you could be working two jobs but just not make very much money, because if you're a person with little education in a modern economy, you're very unlikely to be able to earn enough to feed your own children. So the question is, how generous do Americans want to be? I mean, this is a question. I mean, maybe that's a policy question. Mm. Is immigration a charity program to let in people who are going to be using benefits from the taxpayers, or isn't it? And it seems to me the point of immigration, other than refugees and asylum, which are not covered by this rule, the point of immigration should be to benefit Americans. And there are going to be individual instances where a decision made a different way would have had a different result. There's no question about it. But government policy has to be made on broad trends, not on individual anecdotes.
So Ted Hessen has been listening patiently here. And Ted, just sort of piggybacking off Mark's point about should immigration policy be made to benefit Americans, I am seeing here research from the Pew Institution, from the Pew Group, that says regarding immigration as a whole, that immigrants are projected to drive future growth in the U.S. working age population through at least 2035 as baby boomers retire in ever larger numbers. And immigrants and their children are expected to offset a decline in the working age population by adding 18 million people of working age between 2015 and 2035. That's from Pew. So, I mean, to that point, I mean, aren't immigrants adding to the U.S. economy, which is therefore benefiting the country as a whole?
I don't think there's a question about whether more immigration leads to more GDP growth, gross domestic product growth, which is overall economic activity. And I think most economists and people on both sides of the aisle on this issue would agree with that. I think what the Trump administration is proposing here and saying, though, is that potentially they could be admitting people who are at a higher income or more likely to earn more money over their lifetime, and that perhaps it would actually boost that. I think a key question, and it's come up several times already, is what the effect of this rule will be on future legal immigration flows and people who are getting green cards. And actually, the Homeland Security Department in the regulation did not estimate that and did not provide a projection for what it would mean. And there have been studies that have looked at the number of green card people adjusting to green cards and getting permanent residence in the past who might have been affected by something like this. And there's quite a few number of people who would have been subject to using these benefits. So I think it will be a major question to see how it plays out in practice. And you have to remember that many of these decisions will be at the discretion of consular officers and federal immigration officers here in the U.S. who will review all these different circumstances we mentioned and make a final decision. Should this person get a visa or should this person be allowed to obtain a green card?
Are there sectors of the economy, I'm thinking, for example, home health care workers, where, again, Mark Krikorian was making the point that you can have there are many immigrants in this country that are working multiple jobs, but because they are low-paying jobs, still rely on public benefits to survive. I mean, there are entire industries, again, home health care, where the wages are very low. How are these businesses looking at this potential rule?
I mean, there's been a large outcry from health service providers about this, not necessarily from the financial perspective and running their business, but also from a public health perspective and what it's going to mean if people are not using benefits for themselves or for their families and children that, you know, first of all, affect the individuals, but also could affect their communities at large if they're, you know, not going in for treatment for certain you know, whatever it might be, diseases or things along those lines. And one aspect of this lawsuit I mentioned that was filed in California yesterday is that they're actually saying that the burden is being shifted, the cost burden from the federal government to local governments, and that this could actually increase costs because people may be more likely to go in for emergency room treatment or, you know, to not get treatment and potentially drive up public health costs locally over time.
Well, let's get some callers in here. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from New Orleans. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. So I have family who's in Vietnam. They'd very much like to be here. And if they could walk here, even if it was a 1,000-mile journey, they would do so in an instant. But due to geographic barriers, the only way they could get here is for a sponsor such as us. We've resisted those requests for over 10 years because when we first looked into it, we found that the sponsor is taking on liability and responsibility for all the benefits and all that stuff that they might access if they overstay visas, health insurance while they're here and stuff like that. So these laws have been on the books for a very long time, because this was, we were looking at this when Obama was around, and the lawyer said that, you know, they'd never really go after you, but they are now. There were stories a couple months ago that they started sending bills to people.
Yeah, enforcing those sponsorship, exactly, enforcing the family sponsorship provision. I mean, you sign a piece of paper, essentially, that says you will be responsible for financially for the people that you are sponsoring. I get it. So Michael, what's your question about the Trump administration's new set of rules about public charges?
So I think that this is, you know, one thing that's kind of good here is that it will start to level the playing field for people that can't just come here, you know, overland, that aren't North Americans already, that they have, will hopefully have more access to come to the U.S.
Well, Michael, I'm going to take it back from you there, because we just have a minute to go before the break. And thank you for your call. Jackie Vimo, 30 seconds or so before we have to take a quick break. But did you want to respond to Michael?
Just really quickly, first of all, people who come, there's a difference between what the impact is going to be on people who are already here and people coming from abroad. And I think that that's really important. And people are actually not eligible. Immigrants are not eligible for benefits for the first 5 years that they're in this country. Most people don't know that. So actually, this is actually not going to impact many people, this particular public charge piece. But what it will, who it will impact, is people who are confused, who are going to forego crucial medical care, crucial housing and food supports. And then, as Ted said, they're going to pass the buck down to states and localities to the tune of about $24 billion in lost benefits. And so those people are going to be here, but they're just going to be less healthy. And all of us are going to be less healthy, because there's no way to make just the immigrant in the family less healthy without the whole family going healthy.
We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the Trump administration's new rules about legal immigration and becoming, or possibly becoming, a quote-unquote public charge. The administration would make it much harder, if not impossible, to get a green card for becoming a legal permanent resident if, as an immigrant, you have relied at any time on public benefits like Medicaid or food stamps or housing subsidies. I'm joined today by Ted Hessen. He's immigration reporter for Politico Pro. Jackie Vimo joins us. She's policy analyst for the National Immigration Law Center. That's a center focused on immigration policy and advocacy. Mark Krikorian is also with us. He's executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank that argues for lower levels of immigration. And we've got lots of comments coming in here on this. Alyssa Stankis says, I would like to hear discuss the fact that many immigrants, professionals in their home countries, can't get jobs here in their professional fields and have to take low wage jobs to survive. On Twitter, Iowan for Life says, the U.S. is no longer a low-skilled economy that has numerous low-skilled farm and factory jobs. We have skilled jobs and need skilled labor. We ought to prioritize people to fill these jobs as well as persecuted people. Let's go to Marina, who's calling from Ashland, Massachusetts. Marina, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. So I'm actually on my way to become a citizen today, and I'm absolutely appalled by these proposed changes because, you know, we immigrants, we don't come here in search of food stamps and Medicaid. We come here in search of opportunity. And if we're saying that only people who are rich and skilled may apply. That is absolutely contradicting everything America stands for.
Well, Marina, thank you so much for your call on your way to your citizenship ceremony there. Mark Krikorian, what would you like to say to one of the newest Americans here?
Well, congratulate her. I just gave the speech at a swearing-in ceremony at Mount Vernon last month, actually. So people who have come here legally to join us, we want to welcome them when they finally, are able to actually fully become part of the American people. But a point she made was correct in that very few people abroad are rubbing their hands together and saying, I want to get to America and sign up for some food stamps. It doesn't work that way. People come here to work, or they have relatives here, or whatever it is. People come here for a variety of reasons. Getting welfare is not one of them. But because of our lax standards in this public charge area before this rule, a lot of people who do come here end up getting jobs that don't pay a lot of money. And like we've said several times now, end up qualifying for food stamps, free school lunch, Medicaid, public housing, etc. And it's not a moral critique. Somebody who comes here and is unable to earn enough money to pay for their own bills is not morally inferior or anything like that. This is a business proposition, if you will. Immigration, apart from the refugee and asylum issue, is about letting in people who are going to benefit Americans who are already here. There's really no other legitimate basis for government to make policy decisions. And someone from India, for instance, who is relatively well-educated, has a high-paying job waiting for him, and is not likely to be using government benefits, is not better than someone from Honduras who has a sixth-grade education and is going to be washing dishes. But as far as the effect on Americans who are already here, the likelihood of their using taxpayer-funded, being subsidized by the taxpayer, there's a real difference. And I would say it's illegitimate for government to make immigration decisions without taking that kind of thing into account.
But Mark, if I may, isn't the Trump administration very clearly saying that they do think the higher educated immigrant from India is better than the low wage worker from Honduras? I mean, that is explicitly what the president himself has said. He wants a merit-based system. And what about the flip side of that as well, that there is a job that your example of the Honduran worker is filling? That's a job that they're filling that perhaps, I don't know, if an American didn't want to wash dishes for 12 hours a day, that is a service to the economy. So I guess I'm not quite clear on what you're saying here.
Well, there's two points here. First is what I mean by better, morally better. There's no people are people. We're all children of God. But that's not the basis of immigration decisions, because we have to pick among the hundreds of millions of people who want to move here. As far as a low-skilled immigrant and the jobs that they fill, there's no question that immigrants find work. Like I said, they work at the same rates overall as the native-born. Immigrant men are slightly more likely to work. Immigrant women are slightly less likely, but it all averages out in the end. The issue is, are the jobs that they take able to pay enough so they can support themselves and their family? And are those jobs fixed? Is that a static demand for jobs that if there were, say, fewer low-skilled immigrants, those jobs would somehow go unfilled? The fact is the economy is a dynamic system. Employers would raise wages. They would change the way they do business. They change the way they organize the work, mechanize in some instances, and the economy would adjust. So no, there's no economic need for more and more low-skilled workers. If we had fewer of them, especially in the current economic circumstances where we have the highest level of Americans not in the labor market, in other words, neither working nor looking for work, because the low unemployment rate only counts people who are looking for work.
Right.
So my point is, we're not running out of warm bodies at all.
Okay.
And there's no economic necessity to import low-skilled people who will end up having to be subsidized by the taxpayer.
So, Jackie, I'm going to come to you on that. But first of all, Ted Hessen, let me turn to you. I mean, would the economy adjust? Because I also have a sense that we have a lot of low wage jobs out there because corporations are more than happy to hold those wages pretty low. Or if, as Mark is talking about, if the available pool of workers willing to fill those jobs goes down, would wages rise? I mean, that hasn't happened yet so far.
I mean, some of this will depend on how this regulation plays out and who is admitted and who is denied. We don't have a firm sense of that yet. I mean, we did get some preliminary data that basically back in January 2018, the State Department piloted a kind of lesser version of this regulation. And after they put that into place, we did see that, first of all, the number of people denied visas, immigrant visas on public charge grounds skyrocketed. It went from about 1,000 people in fiscal year 2016, which was the last full year under former President Barack Obama, to about 13,000 in the current fiscal year through the first 10 months of the current fiscal year. And what we did see is that people from certain countries seem to be seeing very high rates of denial. Mexico, for instance, they previously had made up about 1% of the 1,000 public charge denials in 2016. In the current mix of data, they made up about 44% of the public charge denials. We also saw people applying for immigrant visas from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Dominican Republic, Haiti, all saw very sizable increases. So it's not totally clear that those trends will carry over into the broader, more in-depth public charge rule that's just been rolled out. But I do think they should give us a snapshot of what this could mean.
Jackie Vimo, what do you think?
Oh, first of all, I'm glad that that Mark and I agree that people do not come here for benefits. I would love to meet someone who, you know, crawled across the desert to come here for anyone's health insurance plan in 2019. I think that they're coming here. They're only coming here on their way to Canada. But the reality is that there's two different things: how we do the picking and who this is going to be impacting. This is not just about class, because this is about shutting the door to the people who are not white and who are not wealthy. And when we talk about who this is going to impact, 1 in 3 of those people, the percentages of those who are estimated to be impacted by this public charge rule, over 1/3 of Latinos of all Latinos in the United States are potentially impacted by this. The next population is Asian Pacific Islanders and then Black or African Americans. Only 1% of those estimated to be chilled by this are white Americans. So there's a really clear racial dimension, and there's no accident to this. When the president says that Mexicans are rapists and criminals, and when we talk about a Muslim ban, and we talk about the fact that in El Paso, in response to this environment, that there was a horrific mass shooting where 22 people were killed and over 24 people were injured with an intent to kill and murder Latinos, there is a racial dimension to this. But I think more importantly to this, we also have to see once people get here what this impacts, because the message that's being sent to folks. And that is that it's going to be impacting low-income communities that are already here, including U.S.-born, native-born communities of color, African-Americans, because when there are people that are going hungry, because even once they're here, they're going to be scared because they're not going to understand how this works, but they got the message, if you're, you know, brown, if you're a person of color, don't use benefits, they're going to go hungry. And then that's going to be a burden, as Ted said, to the tune of about $24 billion it's going to be the federally qualified health centers that are going to pay for this. It's going to be food pantries. And I think that this is fundamentally about the question of a vision of what America do you want? When we look back 20, 50 years from now, do you want to be on the side of an America where children, simply because of where their parents were born, go hungry and homeless? And I think that that's really the fundamental values question here.
Well, Mark, would you like to offer your answer to that values question Jackie just put out?
I'm afraid this is scaremongering. I mean, this is, first of all, not going to be some kind of whites-only immigration policy. That's silly. There's plenty of people in Latin America who can pay their own bills if they were to move here. To the extent there is going to be a shift, it'll be that immigration the flow may well become somewhat less from Latin America. It would be more from Asia and Africa. Those are going to be the main changes when you look at the skills and education levels and incomes of immigrants. And the idea that immigrants who have come here will somehow be dissuaded from signing up for welfare benefits that they might be able to sign up for or on behalf of their children, that's actually a good thing. I mean, people, welfare is something you should avoid. It's obviously I'm for having a social safety net for people who are in trouble. We're a civilized society. This is a very different situation from 100 or 200 years ago, but I'm for it. But it's still something that ought to be avoided if you can avoid it.
If we're talking about immigrants who have U.S. citizen children who are afraid to apply for food stamp benefits for their U.S. citizen children, how is that a good thing?
It's still money in their pocket. In other words, it's a subsidy for that immigrant family. And my point is that anybody should be trying to avoid using public benefits if possible. I mean, welfare is not a good thing. It's an unfortunate necessity. A necessity to have such a system. I'm all for it, but it is an unfortunate necessity and something you should try to avoid at all costs. And one of the ways, this doesn't apply to everybody, but it does apply pretty broadly. One of the ways you avoid the necessity of relying on public benefits is by not sending money home to your relatives. A very large share of immigrants who use government benefits are also sending extra money home to relatives abroad. And that's, that's not what people are paying taxes for. That's not what the welfare system is for, to subsidize remittances to relatives.
Okay, we're running down on time. Jackie, I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that last point that Mark Krikorian made. Is that a common occurrence of sending remittances home while also accepting public benefits in the United States?
Well, sure, but that's not the point, right? The point is about whether or not who your parents are, whether they're immigrants or not, is going to determine whether or not your kid is healthier or able to access benefits. Whether a kid is scared to go to get school lunch because his mom is an immigrant, right? That shouldn't be part of the equation. If this is just about welfare policy, it shouldn't matter what the nation of origin of your parents are. And I mean, we saw this with the, El Paso shooting. Again, I don't mean to be, inflammatory, but the reality is people didn't go to the hospital because they were scared of going to the hospital after a mass shooting. And that's the message that these kinds of programs, and these kinds of policies are sending to immigrants and communities of color.
I just want to see if I can have enough time to sneak in one or two last calls here. Dominic is calling from Buffalo, New York. Dominic, you're on the air.
Yes, I was just like to make a comment. I don't think this is anything to do with race or racial or Mexicans or anything. It just happens to be the people that are coming across the border or the people that want to get a green card. Why race is always brought into it, I have no idea. If they were coming from Europe or Asia, it doesn't matter where they're coming from. If you can't support yourself, we don't want you.
Well, Dominic, thank you for your call. Let's go to Ken, who's calling from Rapid City, South Dakota. Ken, you're on the air.
This is such a buffoonish argument. So why are we talking about immigrants coming here working, selling their time to a company, not being able to make enough money to support themselves? Why are we talking about that instead of how come people in this country, whether you're a citizen, naturalized, or an immigrant, green card holder, you're selling your time to these companies and you still can't make enough money to feed your family? Raise the wages in this country, fix the education system, repair the healthcare system, and we won't care how many immigrants want to come to this country because everything will be stable. The Trump administration think tank wants people to be scared of the immigrants taking our money now because they failed at calling them rapists. They failed at calling them everything else that they've done. So now they're coming out to our pocketbook, and I just think that's wrong. Stop talking about immigration. Start talking about the things that are affecting the Americans in this country right now, like low wages and corporate corruption in politics.
Ken, I'm going to take it back from you. Thank you so much for your call. Ted Hessen, we've got a minute left to go here, and I just want to get a sense from you about what the immediate future of this new set of rules might be, because they are slated to go into effect roughly in mid-October, right? How likely is that to actually happen?
Well, just based on past immigration initiatives that the Trump administration has rolled out, we know already there'll be one court challenge, but we can even expect more. And what's happened with some other high-profile immigration moves is that they've been challenged in court and then subsequently blocked by judges and then taken up to the federal appeals level and sometimes blocked there as well. So I think certainly that's going to be a strategy for legal opponents of this regulation. And we'll see, I think, in the coming weeks, you know, whether there are moves to try and have a federal judge block this and keep it from going into effect before it does.
Well, Ted Hessen, immigration reporter for Politico Pro, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark Krikori, an executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank arguing for lower levels of immigration. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
And Jackie Vimo, policy analyst for the National Immigration Law Center, a center focused on immigration policy, litigation, and advocacy. Jackie Vimo, pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Pleasure is mine. Thanks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.